morning. I'm going to take just a moment to briefly frame the discussion from the perspective of the Department of Commerce and Innovation, economic research and development in the area of clusters since 1997. In fact, one aspect of our research now, Dr. Ray at Arizona State University, at asset mapping for us. We've been looking for measured outcome measures and indicators that predict positive outcomes. Tools for local practitioners so that it empowers them with the best information we have so that they can add their expertise and increase success. Local competitive advantage, something that's been alluded to. What do they have that's special? I just returned from internet conference Dr. Westner mentioned, and I was invited there by the North Council of Ministers. Extremely interesting to talk to our colleagues in Copenhagen and in Stockholm who are working on these same projects. They have been working at this organized, integrated way across the EU since at least 2005. And in fact, when I spoke to our colleagues at the ministry in Stockholm, the EU's presidency is going to be assumed shortly by Sweden, and they make clusters, transnational in their case, obviously, a focus of that presidency because they believe that it is the key to competitive. EDA is very happy to join the Heinz Foundation and others funding this effort. And the first question is, why do clusters matter? That's a big topic. Fortunately, Dr. Marianne Feldman from UNC, whose work in geographic innovation, and Andrew Reamer, Brookings, Dr. Reamer, among other accomplishments, co-author of the Clusters and Competitiveness Study that was recently released and has been alluded to earlier. Without any further ado, Dr. Feldman.
It's my pleasure to be here this morning to address you. This is very similar to a talk that I've given in Europe, in Japan, in India, in China, and Korea, and it's wonderful to now be giving it in the U.S. Now, Chuck has asked me to talk about sort of the academic viewpoint on cluster development. No regressions, no references to the literature, although I can certainly provide those to you. And I think it's important that we now realize that all growth is local. And so the focus has changed from sort of looking at nations to now looking at subnational units. We realize that growth is local and it's grounded in place. And really this is based on the view that innovation is a cognitive and a conceptual process. It's predicated on people meeting face to face. And also, in that meeting, what happens when people are dealing with something new is that they develop a common meaning and a common language. And the characteristics of knowledge are such that knowledge grows when you share it with other people. There are network effects. And this creates increasing returns. And it results in greater productivity. And I think also when you start looking at firms in context, what we realize is that firms benefit from strategic location. And that doesn't mean sort of attracting a firm to your jurisdiction and having it be there but then quickly move out. It means firms that have deep roots and deep social connections. And so one of the great paradoxes of globalization is that even as we are all more interconnected, what really matters is being in place. And we see clusters forming around the world in other nations because we're physical beings and we're social beings. And so I always love this quote from Robert Medcalf made over 10 years ago. Silicon Valley is probably the only place on Earth not trying to copy Silicon Valley. And so, you know, I think that that was true. But now when we think about sort of creation myths revisited, What we see is that a key question in the literature is, how do clusters come into existence? How do regions change from being inert, that is, places where there's little innovation, little entrepreneurship, flatline economic growth, to being places where there is activity? And, you know, I think that part of what we have learned as a community of scholars is to really rally against what we might call the economic development sausage machine. You line up a research university, some venture capital, some entrepreneurs, turn a crank, and you get economic growth. And increasingly, what we realize is when we study clusters, and there's a wonderful literature now that looks at sort of iconic clusters. So think of Hollywood. Hollywood is so successful with the film industry that we associate the place and the industry with the same term. Is it about climate? Well, no, it's really about the establishment of new business models, a variety of factors, and Alan Scott has written about this. That really create a different way of organizing the film industry. Silicon Valley, was it only about the university or venture capital? Nope, not at all. It really has its roots that go back much further. And so people say, well, you know, it's something about resources or climate, and something about historical accidents or serendipity. But the consensus from the literature is that when we look at cluster development, the most important thing are the social processes and the visions of sort of something new, some new way of doing something, some new way of organizing a vision. For example, in Hollywood, the center for the entertainment industry was New York at the time. And the way New York produced film was to simply look at a stage and to film action on that stage. And in fact, there were a lot of train crashes and dramatic things. Film was sold by the foot. And so it was a commodity, not a high value added product. And so the new idea was to use a studio, to use a continuous script, and that created Hollywood. Also, what happens in area is that we've talked a little bit about leaders. Leaders are certainly important, and stars are important, but stars do best when they're surrounded by constellations. Leaders have to have followers. And so what we see in successful clusters is that a social consensus develops, and this is very important to propelling the industry forward. The idea, I think, of jurisdictional advantage, and if we think about jurisdictions as political entities, and I think, as Susan Crawford indicated, the most important question is, if you are responsible for a place, what do you do to promote? Well, what should be the outcomes? I would argue prosperity and economic growth. And we talk a lot about measurement and what are the things that we ought to be measuring. Here there is a tendency, if we view Silicon Valley, as a recent Milken Foundation report does, then we find that Silicon Valley has an innovative index of 100, and the next closest place is at 50. We don't all want to become like Silicon Valley. I think that when we think about metrics, we have to think about economic outcomes more broadly, thinking about community prosperity. And prosperity is a wonderful word that means that we share in the distribution of the outcomes. And then I think that the large question that we have to address as a society is, what kind of a world do we want to live in? So Silicon Valley, again, reconsidered as the archetype. Well, really, it's an unrealistic model. You could even argue it's an undesirable model. And if you've seen the movie Startup and know about what's involved with the commitment on individuals. But also, increasingly, in Silicon Valley, people recognize that it's not even sustainable. And it's, to me, always been a paradox, because corporate strategy, the essence of corporate strategy, is doing something unique that is not easily replicated. And unfortunately, when we look around the US, we see that everyone is trying to capture a biotech industry, even though a few places have already moved so far ahead. So I think then the question is, well, what's a city, a region to do? And I always sort of go back to designing an economic development strategy may be the ultimate local innovation. And so we see that in Asia, the government is able to top-down dictate that you will have a cluster in a certain location. But in a complex capitalist economy, that's never going to work. The clusters that we have in the U.S. and in Western Europe are very complex, they're self-organizing, and they really are made up of a broad patchwork, an ecology of actors and institutions. The role of government, I think, is providing the appropriate incentives. And a wonderful book by Nicholas Taleb called The Black Swan. Okay, we always have perceptions about what is possible, what is feasible, and what are going to be the likely outcomes. And those are always based on our prior experience and looking backwards. And so what the Black Swan teaches us is that it's difficult to anticipate new technologies or future economic change. So then the paradox is, well, what's a government to do? And actually, I think that government is much more complicated than firms. Firms have a simple objective function. When you are a government, what should be your desired outcome? I think it's probably to maximize the residents' income and then their wealth. And so an economic development strategy that will work in a place has got to be predicated on a deep understanding of what that place is about. And so really, within economics, we find that firms are one way of organizing economic activity. Geography is arguably another. And we have to think about coherent systems, that ideas don't stop at political boundaries. And also when we think about states, well, you know, the view from Asia is regions. And so we've got a very sort of different conceptualization. Our political boundaries are really historically driven, and what really matters much more is the flow of ideas. And so contiguous localities, I think we're going to hear some interesting examples of how localities are working together. And I think that probably a good way to look at this is to think of political units as subsidiaries or divisions of the same economic entity, and so that places can be involved in complementary activities. I think it's also very important when you're thinking about an economic development strategy to consider a place's a sort of position in the urban hierarchy and what is feasible, and spend time on what's feasible, not what's not going to work. And I think when we think about clusters, there's also a danger. We're thinking about concentrations of resources. Do we really want to live in a world where everyone is in a city? I think that we need to consider the sort of synergies between urban and rural areas. And one of the most remarkable things now is that state and local governments have been engaged in a variety of technology-based economic development initiatives. And this has been going on for now arguably 30 years, and there are wonderful lessons to learn from these laboratories. So to Susan Crawford's sort of question, what is the role of government? Well, I think we need to recognize that when we look at an economy, private activity is just the tip of the iceberg. What really enables innovation is capacity, incentives, and then also institutions. And so what we have seen, the growth of these new quasi-governmental entities, public-private partnerships, nonprofit foundations, who are really a catalyst in a lot of this in this process. And so I think it's also important to remember that economic development policy is increasingly about social policy and enabling human potential. So the terms of a new debate, again, we use a lot of biological metaphors, and a lot of those come from evolutionary biology. But I think that rather than thinking about competition and survival of the fittest, which leads us to a winner-take-all, very skewed economic distribution, a casino economy, that it's more important to take some other lessons from evolutionary biology, which is to think about the advantages to immunity. And so we would never, as an investor, you would never say to an investor, put all of your money in one stock or one sector. You would say diversify. The same lesson needs to be true for an economy. And so critical things are resiliency, which is the ability to survive external shocks, and then also diversity. And I think we have talked a lot so far about the role of universities. The dirty little secret for university tech transfer is that very few offices make money at tech transfer. But what universities still provide a very fundamental resource. They're critical institutions in the establishment of clusters. And I think we need to, as we think about entrepreneurship, also accord some currency to the more mundane activities. Frequently, people disdain what are called lifestyle entrepreneurship, yet those can be very viable businesses. I think that we sort of can, in the literature, conceptualize government as the agent of collective action. You can think about who are the customers for government. Well, the job-providing entities, certainly, but these any government action should be subject to citizens' preferences. And so again, to be viable in a local economy, sort of the literature suggests that the focus is on building local capacity. Building on, as Michael Crow said, your existing expertise, focusing on local problems, those problems that are really well understood and for which the resources are at hand. And then once products are developed, it's easy to scale and move to global markets. And also, rather than just focusing on funding R&D, I think that we need to focus on the big problems. And so we see that, again, systems, applied R&D yields incremental ideas, basic ideas, yields and builds out new technology platforms. And we see in the most vibrant clusters, we've been doing some work looking at NSF's Partnerships for Innovation programs, and they build very strong partnerships between universities, community colleges, and local high schools, integrating and bringing everyone to the table. And so I think that what universities provide most and our best output are our graduates. And when we want to focus on cluster development, I think there needs to be a sort of a reminder that education is what we've been doing the longest, and it's what we do best. And it should be broad-based universal education, taking advantage of all the resources, very different from training, and again, a focus on social policy. And so just to end, I think that we now have this opportunity where with globalization, a critical point is, will we have an equalization? That is, will other nations come up to the U.S. standard of living? Or will we have a reversal, and will the U.S. lose ground and lose our standard of living? And I think it's also important in this dialogue to remember what the end of all of this innovation emphasis was supposed to be about. It's the amelioration of disease and human suffering. And, you know, certainly creating value and capturing, you know, creating value is important, but it should be about creating value and not simply capturing the rents. And I just sort of sometimes question whether innovation has the tendency to become an end to itself, and we don't think about the larger purposes. So to end on a more positive note, I think we're poised for what could be a new golden age. And instead of treating knowledge as a commodity, we should really teach it as, think of knowledge as something that enhances human potential. And rather than thinking about people as skilled inputs to production, we can think about them more broadly for their human potential. Thank you.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. Thank you to Chuck and to Adam for organizing this and inviting me, and to Bill for moderating. I'm Andrew Remer with the Brookings Institution, and as has been discussed a year ago, I and Karen Mills, who's now the SBA administrator, and Elizabeth Reynolds produced a paper on clusters and competitiveness as part of the Blueprint for American Prosperity series that the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program is putting together in anticipation of a new administration. My talk today is essentially pulling elements from that piece with some updating. So here's what I'm going to go through today. Policy-relevant characteristics of clusters, cluster initiatives and programs, the absence of federal policy and a federal role in stimulating regional economies, principles of approach. The title of this talk was, if my piece, I was asked to talk about stimulating regional economies, so I'm going to, at the end, go a little broader than clusters, put clusters in context of stimulating regional economies more broadly. Okay, clusters have a number of policy-relevant characteristics. They're all unique. They differ in purpose and scope, in composition, and their trajectories of growth, development, and adjustment to external circumstances. Experience suggests that there are three critical factors of cluster success: collaboration, that is, relationships, the skills and abilities of the people in the workforce and people at the head of the organizations in the cluster, and the cluster organizational capacities for innovation. Innovation as traditionally thought of in terms of technology, products and processes, but also in how to do business and how to relate to one another. One thing, my experience in economic development is there is a lot of magical thinking, right? That Marianne alluded to the notion that every place wanted to be Silicon Valley. And it's, you know, I've been in the economic development business for 25 years. There are just waves of magic bullets that people latch onto. In the 80s, it was incubators. Things go in cycles. And clusters is, you know, has that danger of it's the next magic bullet. The reality is that for any industry, there's a handful of dominant clusters. So I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but the last time I looked, for biotech, it was San Francisco, San Diego, and Boston, you know, took more than half of the activity in that area. It's very difficult for smaller areas to break in. The more successful you are, the more likely it is you're going to pull in firms from other places because they want to be where the action is. So University of Pittsburgh had a biotech initiative, and they had some moderate success in building new firms, but when they got to a certain size, they left. Want to be in Pittsburgh, you want to be in San Diego. I was also struck, there was a little article in the paper last week about a venture capital firm had been in Boston for three decades and chose to move to Silicon Valley last week, right? Boston is declining now as a center for venture capital for technology-funded innovation. Clusters are the economy's in a perpetual state of economic transition, so cluster dominance cannot be taken for granted. I mean, we all grew up with clusters. They were very focused clusters. Akron made tires, right? Hartford did insurance. Detroit made cars. Toledo made glass. And you had in those places, that's where the industry was. You know, you had a dominant cluster in the country. And then as information technology and transportation improved, we started splitting off the functions so that the nature of clusters has changed. There are clusters that are industry-focused that combine a lot of functions in one place, but a lot of our clusters are function-specific. You think about Memphis or Louisville around transportation and transportation hubs, for instance. New products and services, of course, can disrupt cluster dominance. So, in designing a federal policy regarding promoting clusters, it's important to keep these factors in mind, I think. Okay, clusters, initiatives, and programs. The notion is that cluster initiatives are formally organized efforts to. Promote competitiveness through collaborative activities and a variety of collaborative activities. It's trying to facilitate, to grease the kind of the natural collaborative tendencies to overcome certain barriers to collaboration among the actors in a cluster. And here are a series of activities that cluster initiatives promote. Market development, education, and training activities where firms and with universities, community colleges, nonprofit organizations are working together, research, R&D, and commercialization, adopting innovation, actually doing innovation diffusion within a cluster, promoting networking within the cluster, within the region, and with clusters in other locations, attracting firms and workers, right? You need for cluster growth, you want that, and new business development from within, and representing cluster interests before external organizations, whether it's the regional economic development partnership, or the state government, or a federal regulatory agency. And so when we look at, there have been a lot of cluster initiatives going on around the country, popping up here and there in a very ad hoc, bottom-up kind of way. When we look at them, we see that they're present across the full array of industry sectors. So today we talk about clusters in innovation. I want to be clear that clusters cluster initiatives are occurring in mature industries as well as the newer industries. And that innovation, of course, can take place across the whole array of industries, no matter how old they are. They are typically in clusters of regional economic importance. They carry out a diverse set of collaborative activities. I went through the list in the last slide of what's possible. Most cluster initiatives do at least four of those things that I showed you. Some follow economic boundaries, that is, they focus on a region, natural economic region. Others focus on political boundaries. They may be a city initiative. It's not too typical. Very often a state initiative. There are lots of state cluster initiatives. They're typically industry-led with active government and nonprofit involvement. They can be a subsidiary effort, for instance, an offshoot of a chamber of commerce or a public-private partnership, or they can be a standalone, something that looks a lot like a trade association. They typically have a dedicated facilitator, somebody who is trying to keep the conversation going, keep that collaboration going. And they can be teeny, and they can go to several hundreds of participants. We find that cluster initiatives that are successful share several characteristics. They tend to be industry-led. They're inclusive, that they want to bring everybody to the conversation. There's this natural tension between you're working with your competition and you're trying to collaborate at the same time. So finding ways to bring people in, people who compete with one another, people in the supply organizations in the supply chain, the nonprofit organizations that do the education and training, intellectual property people, and so on and so on. Particularly state and local government decision makers, the regional economic development people. Successful cluster initiatives have a vision they have an understanding of where they are, where they'd like to be, and the roadmap of how to get there. And then they encourage broad participation and collaboration in the implementation of that roadmap. They are typically, successful ones are well-funded, maybe from outside sources and inside sources, some combination. And they have they found a way to be self-sustaining financially over the long term. And they do link successfully with the external organizations I mentioned before. So bottom line for me is that properly organized initiatives can promote cluster competitiveness. That's good for the nation. It's good for the nation to have well-designed, well-implemented cluster initiatives. However, cluster initiatives often emerge as a natural firm-led outgrowth of cluster development, they often do not. There's a number of barriers, certain kinds of market failures. It's a public good or a free rider problem. Who do you get to start this thing? There's a lot of upfront time and effort. And if you're trying to run a firm, do you want to try to start a cluster organization at the same time? There's a tendency for people to want to hold back and let somebody else do it. There can be different regions and different industries have different cultures. And in some places, there's more trust, and in some places, there's more mistrust among firms. That's a barrier if there's more mistrust. There can be a lack of knowledge about who the right players are, how you start one of these things, and how you make it successful. So it's kind of a lack of technical knowledge, best practices. So as a result of these barriers, state and local public purpose organizations, public-private partnerships, sometimes governments, are taking an active role in starting cluster initiatives. Some are doing this in an ad hoc, one-off manner. Massachusetts started the Mass Medic Council, I think it's called, which is a state association of medical device manufacturers. But other places are saying, we want to do this across a number of clusters, so we're going to start a program. And some states like Oregon and South Carolina and some cities like Louisville, Kentucky, have programs that where they're creating clusters, 4 to 8 or more cluster initiatives within their area. A lot of experimentation going on. They differ in many different ways. And at the same time, the network of the nation's state and regional cluster initiatives is thin and uneven for the same kinds of reasons that a local cluster initiative has trouble getting started. There's barriers to states and cities, regions getting involved in this, lack of information, lack of financial resources, particularly at this moment in time, and other pressing priorities and so forth. So that suggests that there's a role for the federal government in this space. But our federal government has been active, or not present up to this point. You look around the world, national governments play a central role in cluster development, not in the U.S., though. The 31 EU nations, last year, 26, had a cluster initiative program at the national level, as do Japan and Korea. The EU operates this terrific entity that, in our proposal, we borrowed straight from it, a European cluster observatory which maps clusters and cluster initiatives across the EU. This is to say the EU itself, as a supranational organization, is very focused on the importance of clusters for Europe. The federal government has been almost entirely active from the realm of cluster initiative programs. There's a nice synergy between the local programs that are on site. They're good at relational and technical assistance tasks. You know, being the facilitator, a national program has the value of providing the on-site actors with information, which is a public good. You only have to create it once and you can share it. Knowledge about best practices and financial resources. A federal program can span political boundaries, which is difficult, particularly across states, and it can stimulate nationwide coverage. But the federal government has been absent in this realm, mainly because our national economic policy has traditionally focused since the 40s on managing the economic cycle. Right? Back in the day when Akron made tires and Detroit made cars, the economic structure was not an issue. The issue was depression and inflation. So we built up this macroeconomic structure to take care of that. And national economic policy rarely thought about economic structure until the 1980s. In the 50s and 60s, you had things like NSF and the highway system being set up well outside of bounds of economic policy. The 60s was focused on equity, no region left behind, EDA got started. And it wasn't in the 80s, all of a sudden, economic structure blew up, right? You lost 25% of our manufacturing jobs in the space of 24 months. But our national economic policy has been a mess. You know, it's around the structural stuff. We've had a series of these one-off efforts, ad hoc efforts, siloed efforts. There's a list of them there, or a handful. But when Susan alluded to a number actually from our paper about 250 programs, $77 billion, I mean, this is, you know, evidence of this ad hoc approach to trying to deal with how do you staunch the bleeding and actually move forward to something more effective in terms of regional economic policy. The federal government, our national economy still is macro-focused. This administration now is trying to figure out how to integrate macro with regional economic development, issues of economic structure. We don't have a competitiveness strategy. The federal government has, to this point, failed to recognize national competitiveness as a function of regional competitiveness. And regional competitiveness is largely a function of cluster competitiveness, not entirely, but to a large degree. But the result is we have had no clusters policy. I got a red light here. Federal role, principles of approach, there's five principles I want to lay out to you about we now think it's time for the federal government to enter the space, not only for clusters, but for regional economic development and competitiveness in general for the purposes of a stronger national policy, national economy, an approach that would integrate the focus on managing cycle and economic structure in a more integrated way. Okay, principle one, federal government's approach should be flexible, bottom-up, and collaboration-oriented rather than prescriptive, top-down, and input-focused. I want to use a physics analogy here. It's a shift from thinking about Newtonian physics. The world is a machine, right? I mean, that's the Great Society programs, the focus of it's Marianne's sausage factory. It's here's a bunch of inputs, you get to this output. The world doesn't work that way. It's more like quantum physics. You have millions and billions of independent decision makers, lots of uncertainty. The role of the federal government is to catalyze, to increase the probability of effective action at the bottom. The government, to do that, should have a diverse toolkit, including information, knowledge, and grants. Money is expensive. Information is not. So information should be the first tool. Grants is the tool of last resort. Folk, at the same time, funded at an appropriate level of need. Strategically, you want to look at ways to catalyze those other 250 programs, bring their money into the process. The key element to economic regional competitiveness is building the capacity of state and local organizations to themselves catalyze competitiveness. So the role of the federal government is to build capacity at the regional level, have the local actors in turn be more effective. And then last point here, federal policy should link, leverage, and align existing federal programs, you know, create synergies among what is. This is going to take a new kind of federal culture. So not a small deal. The principles here are the principles that led to our proposal for the clusters program that's in the EDA FY10 budget. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Run into the coffee break time, and I'm afraid stamp.
Yes, I think if you don't mind, I think I'd like to thank really an outstanding panel for some very valuable contributions. We will hopefully get a little closer back on track. Could I have a round of applause for the entire panel here? Could I ask you to return to this room? But I would like just one comment. In thanking sponsors and participants this morning, I neglected to thank Ed Paisley of the Center for American Progress and Jim Turner, who were instrumental in convincing me that we had nothing else to do in June, so we might as well organize this meeting. I'd like to express our thanks. And also to Robin Gaster, who was instrumental in ensuring me that it was possible, which now it begins to seem may well be.